in my mind, I'm like, can we just have like a season of time of peace?
Yeah.
Can we just have to be able to breathe and it be just calm waters? And I don't remember exactly how you framed it, and you can clarify, but there was something that you basically just like, I want to call it wag. I felt the book was wagging its finger. He's like, all right, that's not what you get to do. Yeah,
it was actually wagging right at you.
Yeah. Did I screw that up?
And you can get Listen Up for only $14.99.
Todd Bolsinger is with us. You're going to be doing some work here at Chapel Wood. And we're also joined, Matt Russell and I, with Sarah Barnett, who is one of our executive pastors and who helps a lot at Chapel Wood with strategic planning and processing and kind of keeping us on track with everything that she's doing. And she's also now doing a D-man with you at Fuller.
Right.
So you're going to get double teamed all the time on leading change.
Like a mini Todd Bolsinger everywhere.
So I don't have any, like, you should know Todd is, but if you don't, I mean, I don't have your illustrious, like long 80-page bio in front of me, but Todd's with A. Sloan Management, or consulting leadership, and also you've been with Fuller for a long time, been a pastor, but you just, you've written some wonderful books, Cooling the Mountains. What is the
Tempered Resilience.
Tempered Resilience. Yeah, I like that one because it was about pounding me into shape during COVID. I needed to learn. So you've got some new stuff that's coming out of leading change and how to not waste a crisis. You sent me some of these to read ahead of time, and I read them, and like, we're going to talk about in a little while, you know, one of them that kind of really pissed me off, ticked me off. Sorry, Mom, I didn't mean to say a bad word. But first, why don't you just tell us like what's going on in your life right now, the kind of things you're excited about. And we're glad you're here.
I'm so glad to be back. Well, one of the things I'm excited about is being back with all of you guys. It's like one of my favorite places to do a bunch of work. And so it's fun. You know, basically, our little company, AE Sloan Leadership, works across the world now. We now have some clients international that is all on people leading change. It's basically, how do you help faith leaders thrive as change leaders? And because leading change is the thing that creates the most amount of tension and friction and resistance and disappointment and anger. And it's just really, it's the hard stuff. It's like, it's one thing to manage complexity and do a better job of what we did last year. It's another thing to have to actually change and let stuff go and try something new. And so basically our little company works literally in lots of different places, including universities and nonprofits, and it's really fun. So
I know you've worked with us. You work with a lot of churches too, right?
Yeah. Lots of churches, denominations. Like right now we're working with two different denominational leadership groups. One of them's international. Another one is both of them are international denominational groups. We're working with, we're just finishing up Baylor University's strategic plan.
Oh yeah. That's big.
So we've been helping them for that for the last year, which has been a lot of fun. Last year I was in Bangkok with World Vision, working with their Vision Finance group.
Wow.
You know, that's, talk about a challenge. They do micro lending, right, for very poor people who, if you give them a small amount of money, they can turn that into a little cottage business that can just change their lives economically. Mm-hmm. So I asked them, this is like my typical thing, so what is the biggest challenge you're facing? How do you do micro lending with refugees? People who will never have an address, a permanent address again for the rest of their lives. How do you create models to make sure you get the money in a safe way that's actually like a bank that loans them money? That's the problem they were working on. And it was
when you change it from micro lending to micro gifting.
Yeah. Well, see, they're really committed to the lending part because they really want to create an economy that is entrepreneurial and not charitable. Yeah. So it's this, I'm talking to this guy like, that alone, like, okay, how do you create a world that does that? So these are the folks that we get to work with in lots of different places. It's really fun.
A couple things I want to talk about in the short time that we're going to have together. One is this new series of books that you're putting out. Also want to talk about some of the stuff you're going to do here, because we have a lot of folks from Chapelwood that are going to be listening to all of that. And then there was another third thing, and I will remember it once we get there. Let's start with these books, the series. So I know you sent a lot of folks to look at them. I read some, and wrote up. The first one is kind of it's called How Not to Waste a Crisis. Now, this is a series of books through InterVarsity. Talk a little bit about how did this come about and how you feel this is going to be helpful and why it's important.
Yeah. So a bunch of our work over the last few years is all on what's called adaptive change, which is how do you lead change when there are no best practices? When you can't just say, oh, we're going to do that program better. We're going to, oh, we're going to do a better job of putting stuff on the internet, or, you know, you have to actually change things and you have to adapt. So what we found is working with a lot of really good leaders, I mean, really good folks doing good work, there were like four big mistakes our best leaders kept running into. Like four, I said, there are four most common mistakes of really good leaders. And the first one, how not to waste a crisis, is what most really good leaders do when they face something they've never faced before is try to outwork it using their old best practices. Like, they'll just double down on what they've always done, right? And so one of the things we often talk about is like, so what is your leadership superpower? Like, what's the thing that you go to no matter what? And I always say mine is talking the thing to death. Like, I'll preach a sermon series on it, right? Like, oh, I've never done that before, but I'm sure I can preach a sermon series on it, right? And so you start realizing, oh, when I'm done with that, then what am I gonna do? I'll probably talk some more, right? So you started realizing during crisis, people were getting exhausted during COVID because what they were really trying to do is outwork something like COVID.
Yes.
Or outwork, like you can just, so the big mistake is trying too hard. It's actually trying to, everybody has in the back of their head, like this little voice, maybe it's a coach or your parent or something that says, don't just stand there, do something.
Do something.
Yeah. What we have to actually teach people is don't do something.
Just stand there.
Stand there until you can see the shift that has to happen.
Yeah.
Then you can start experimenting your way forward. But it's really hard when leaders are looking at you going, so what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We're losing our kids. We're losing young adults. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And you have to actually sit there and say to them, I don't know. But we're going to learn our way forward. So we're going to learn how to prototype our way forward. Small experiments.
It was interesting. You and I, Sarah and I were talking earlier that often in organizations, it feels like you have to remove the barriers even to get to the questions.
Right.
That we want to get to the questions, right? And we might have a right question, but if the barriers are there, then you can't actually get to the work.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's an organization or a group that says, hey, what do we need to remove so we can get to the questions that the Spirit's asking us to ask in this context?
Yeah. So what do we need to stop doing?
Yeah.
To create enough space to even experiment with something else.
Yeah.
Right? So almost every leader I know, I'll say stuff like, well, let's try some adaptive experiments. And literally the first thing they're thinking is, when am I going to have time to do that?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, there's a sermon coming up on Sunday. I got a meeting on Tuesday. Right. I got to pick up my kids from daycare. Like, okay, until you can learn to stop doing something, then you can actually, you won't be able to discover the new thing to do. So
something I've always been fascinated with, you know, I did a lot of stuff with organizational culture and leadership and systems. And then after I did all that work in my doctorate, I found this kind of journey through contemplative spirituality. Got real into the Desert Fathers, got real into centering prayer and all of that sort of stuff. And I was so amazed at how much they bled into each other. Because if you read all these huge, like what you would call sort of the axial cornerstone business or culture or leadership books that are out there, every one of them have some element of, and they define it different ways, usually using secular terminology,
right.
Like personal mastery, professional proficiency, you know, level 5 leadership, you know, everybody has like a thing, they use it, and you come back to it and you go, man, this is really contemplative spirituality. So when you talk about working, that's that kind of that faith we grow up to solve the problem, whereas contemplative spirituality, it's like, let's just sit and contemplate. It sounds so passive.
Yep. Well, so one of the things we teach people to do is you don't just sit there. What you do is you start making observations. So you start, we took this piece from Ronald Heifetz and Marty Linsky, observations, interpretations, questions. Like your goal is to get to new questions. And then you try interventions, experiments. So the first thing you do is just get people together and go, so what do you see? What do you see? What do you see? What do you see? And everybody's done in about 10 minutes. And you go, one more time. What else do you see? What else do you see? And you start realizing, oh, now we're looking at this problem really differently because we've gotten lots of observations. Well, that's how discernment starts. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to listen to many voices. We're going to trust the Spirit's going to work. And then when you get to interpretations, you ask people, so what do you think? And the key is getting diverse interpretations.
Yeah.
Right? So think of how different anything is if you ask a person in two different life stages or two different economic settings or two different experiential settings, right? They have a different interpretation.
Yeah.
That alone just opens up now what are the new questions we want to try and explore.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm not the best explainer of contemplative spirituality. When I say it's passive, it's not at all, because when you're sitting there, you're actually turning inward. Yeah. You're asking yourself questions.
Yeah.
You're asking God questions, and you're asking things to be revealed to you, but you have to sit and listen for those things.
You have to slow down.
You have to slow down.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Is it about awareness, becoming aware, so that, like, when we talk about or pray for a new imagination, like, that doesn't come when I'm running 90 miles an hour. Often it comes as I slow down, and I'm aware of the things I'm trying to solve that my own kind of skill set is not going to solve. Like, I actually need a power greater than myself, you know?
Right. Like, just paying attention to the fact that I feel chaos. I feel chaotic. Mm-hmm. So we were in church last week. I was thinking about you, Sarah, because we were in church last week at our church, and we had a guest preacher who did this really thoughtful, evocative sermon. Mm-hmm. But in our church's liturgy, we immediately went into announcements.
Good segue,
right? And so afterwards, somebody came up and said, "What'd you think?" I thought, and I was with somebody else who said, "It was a great sermon, but we went into announcements." And I literally said, "I was at." First time I ever came to Chapelwood, I remember you leading right at the beginning of the service, instead of a call to worship, leading to like this moment of like prayer of examine.
Yeah.
And I thought, for some of those people sitting out there, it might be the first time in a week that they just sat and listened, right? And I've watched you do this. I tell this story about you doing this all the time, because I thought, oh man, how many calls to worship are actually not a call to stand and yell? But sit and reflect, right?
Yeah. To be here in this moment.
So question, the way my brain works, or think about it, you go into any of these systems, you're going into churches, organizations, whatever it is, and you're teaching them to engage in this process of adaptive change leadership. How much of that is almost like, it's almost like methodology versus how to create and change the culture of a place so that they naturally, when the next crisis comes, that's the default, rather than thinking of it as a plan of action.
Yeah. So we tell people, we do strategic planning, but we tell them our goal, we will hand you a plan. You're going to want a plan. But that's like handing you a map. What we're going to do is teach you, here's the map, and here's what you need to do to be able to actually travel on that map.
Yes.
Which is going to be different, because we're going to go over mountains and we're going to go over different terrain. So we always say, we don't just do strategic planning. We help you develop your capacity to be adaptive about all your plans. So it's really a formational process.
Yeah.
It's really is what it boils down to, is with every church or group we work with, we're like, look, we can come up with a plan. The problem is most of us have plans all over the place that are like having maps on the wall of trips we never took. And what we want to do is create the capacity to actually lean into those
things. It's interesting. At Chapelwood, I feel like we have not been working plans. We've been doing a lot of formation. And so now it's kind of time to say, okay, we've been formed in a place to where this is not a reach for us, but now we kind of need a
Well, when I was with you guys right out of COVID, the big thing we talked about is everybody came out of COVID going, we need to do formation for everyone.
Yes.
Like that was one of the pieces. Like, formation is not just what you do with kids.
Because people weren't ready.
Yeah. Or formation is not what you do. Like, it's the extra added thing. Right. It's like, now we need to do that.
I mean, no one was ready for COVID, but people weren't ready for the level of adversity in their life and lack of control.
Yeah. And expose the ways that we weren't ready, you know, spiritually and emotionally. And
The crisis, I always say, crisis reveal the things that were there all along.
Mm. Right.
In the same way that, like, when you're leading somebody in contemplative prayer, like, it's not like, oh, all of a sudden I got anxious. It's, I've been anxious all week.
And now I just see it, right? I have no other things to cover up or cope with. It's exposed and out there.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about when you, and not wasting a crisis, you use the terms the dance floor and a balcony. Uh-huh. So you're talking about, okay, not just do something, don't default to your expertise or your skill set, right? Listen. listen again, listen again, listen again. But then you talk about making a move.
Yeah.
Like the balcony, you talk about a shift before solving the problem. Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah. So one of the parts we talk a lot about is it's from Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky who did this work. They say when you're in the middle of the swirl of something, a case, a crisis, a chaos, kindergarten, whatever it is, like just you're in the middle of anything, it's like you're being on a dance floor. I said, just think of it like you're asked to be the chaperone for a junior high dance, right? Music's loud, Axe body spray everywhere. Like it's just kind of overwhelming,
or not.
Right?
Yeah,
right? It's just overwhelming. So if all of a sudden you said, okay, down here we can see some stuff that's going on, but there's a balcony that we could see up from the top. What you start noticing is, oh, there are these patterns. We can't hear, but we can see. So I say, so down here we hear people yelling at each other or talking. Up here we go, I don't know what's going on in that corner, but that is not good. Whatever those guys are doing in that corner, somebody should get down there. Or, I don't know what happened, but this person walked in and everybody cheered her on. I don't know what that was about, but there's like energy. Yeah. So part of what we try to teach people is when you're trying to actually navigate change, you need both to be close, to listen to people, to empathize, to hear their pain, but you also need some perspective. So that when somebody walks up to you and says, you know, everybody in the church is mad about this. Mm-hmm. Or you can get up on the balcony and go, oh, your small group didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't everybody. Everybody's a big word.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love the idea. I'll tell you, in reading a couple of the books, the one that I've already shared with you that kind of ticked me off was the one of the four, Invest in Transformation. And it's been a couple of months since I've read it, but I basically remember it this way, is that it takes a long time to build trust. Yeah. Once you build trust, once you build influence, once you have that leadership and the culture and all this kind of stuff, and you've been through all this adversity, you've kind of built all this capital, you know, in my mind, I'm like, can we just have like a season of time of peace?
Yeah.
Can we just have to be able to breathe and it be just calm waters? And I don't remember exactly how you framed it, and you can clarify, but there was something that you basically just like, I want to call it wag. I felt the book was wagging its finger. He's like, all right, that's not what you get to do. Yeah.
It was actually wagging right at you.
Yeah. It said, John.
And I think in my little write-up that I sent to you, I was like, do not read this book if you are a leader and you've been praying for everything to just like calm down, and yet you still need to lead.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
still need to step in and use the trust and the influence and all the things that you've gained through the adversity to actually now take the next bold step. Talk a little bit about that, because I want to get mad again.
So one of the things to talk about is there is absolutely no transformation without trust. There's no transformation without trust. We all know this, right? None of us will follow anybody we don't trust. And we've all watched, you know, institutions and nations and churches be devastated by moral and fiscal and just emotional immaturity that ruined trust, right? We all seen that. Like one of my clients is a international denomination that went through a very public scandal, right? Very public. And they have to rebuild trust. The problem is that when we're leaders who have not done those bad things, what happens is everybody looks at you and goes, it's so good you're here. We'll just keep things calm all the time. If we can just keep John happy, so we don't have to go through a transformation, if we can just make sure we don't have to get another associate pastor and, oh my gosh, look, we've got a great young leader in Sarah. What we just need to do is make everybody happy. What happens is after a while, you're declining.
Yeah.
Transformation requires the investment of trust. It's like, I would say, it's like if you're going to, you know, if you're going to redo a building project, you got to raise the money. But having a bunch of money in the bank is not the same thing as having a new building. Mm-hmm. You're going to actually have to spend it down. And so you can't squander trust, but you also can't hoard it. And a lot of us think because there's been so many people who've squandered and been untrustworthy, we want trustworthy leaders. But the point of a trustworthy leader is that they're going to take us deeper into something that requires us to trust in God.
That's right.
For transformation.
Yeah.
And that's what's hard. That's where, especially when you've been here, I mean, you're saying you've been here 11 years, John. So like to be in a place where you guys have this team that is doing well and you've come through COVID and things are going well, the question you should be asking is, okay, God, you know, for more much is given, much is required. Mm-hmm. So what's required of us? Yeah. What's the challenge that you want us to take on? What's the, if you blessed us or you restored us, we're doing well. Mm. It's not just to be comfortable.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a spiritual director that says another word for faith is just trust.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, another word for faith is risk.
Risk. Yeah. Risk. Oh, yeah. 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 Oh.
That we have to risk forward in what God calls us to.
Yeah. Right?
And out of that trust for each other and with each other, that's the base. But it's not, I don't think, then to kind of section off and close down or what, play it safe.
Yep. And I've watched this happen. I've been with some places where, you know, there's been a long pastorate. Mm. And there's one church we worked with, the pastor had been there 40 years. And they brought in a new pastor. And the new pastor was smart. Because she was a woman, she said, it's the first time they've had a new pastor in 40 years. And it's the first time they've had a woman pastor. So anything goes wrong, it's going to be pretty easy to go, well, we brought in this young, inexperienced woman instead of the, you know, the guy we trusted. So they literally, before she took the call, she said, I'll say yes to this call, but I'm not going to come for 6 months. And they hired our company to do an assessment where we could identify the transformations they were going to need to go through.
Yeah.
So she could step in and say, I love you guys, but we're going to have to change some stuff.
Yes.
Right. And that, I mean,
that's good.
Like she knew that she didn't have the trust to lead that.
That's right. And the system had to look at itself.
Yeah.
It couldn't then like scapegoat someone that's coming in saying, well, we were fine until you got here, you know, which was often the case with pastoral changes, right? Yeah. The system doesn't have a chance to say, what are the barriers that we've kind of grown accustomed to?
Well, as Methodists, we don't do interims.
Right. Right.
You well, traditionally, we haven't.
Right.
And so I'm kind of like still old school. It's like, yeah, we don't do interims. But I think there's a value to have some space, but you have to be intentional in what you do in that space. Right. You can't just have a break.
Yeah.
Everybody calm down, wait for the new person. And let's hope enough time passes that you don't remember the really good pastor.
The good pastor we all love.
That we all love.
Really,
because it's not going to be 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, or a year. They're still going to remember.
Yeah.
Hell, they still remember pastors from like 82 years ago. Yeah. I remember when Kelly was here, man. It was really the good old days. Hadn't been here for 32 years, but those were the good days.
Yeah.
Know? No, I think that the section I found, it's that the question is like, so you're a leader people trust, you've got the skills, you've been through things, you got the technical competence, the relational congruence, you're safe, you're secure, good for you. So what are you going to do with all that? Now I will say I'm kind of trying to I'm self-deprecating putting myself in the bad seat here, because the reality is, I mean, since I came, I mean, it seems like it's just been chaos, adversity, difficulty, struggle, strain, our denominational stuff, political stuff, cultural stuff, pandemic stuff. I mean, you name it, right? Yep. It's been everywhere. We've had natural disasters in Houston that have changed the community. And so for me, it was not like I've got all this trust and I just want to sit and build bigger barns like the guy in Luke, right? And just kind of sit and be fat and happy for us. My whole thing was like, it's like when you're running, like when I played football in high school, you know, like run is like, I need a break before I run 5 miles. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I'm ready to go.
Some water here.
I can go, but I need a timeout.
And I would put it this way. One of the things we talk a lot about is you're being honest enough to realize, hey, I do need a break.
Yeah.
I need a rhythm of leading and not leading. Yes. We talk about is actually a way people will trust you more. Because they're going to trust that you're not just overworking, or it's not about your ego, or you're not trying to prove something.
Yes.
That there is a rhythm to it, right? So, you know, we talked about trust and transformation. One of the things we talk a lot about is almost everybody, one of the mistakes leaders make is trying to appease everybody, please everybody.
Yeah.
If you try to think, I've got to make all the stakeholders happy, and we're not going to move until everybody's happy, you'll never move.
No.
So even disappointing people to say, I need a break. I was with an Episcopal church in San Antonio a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the fact that at our church, we came to a place where we finally, when I was pastoring, where we gave up meetings for Lent.
Sounds beautiful.
Well, it's like, really everybody I know goes, oh, yeah. And this is what always happens. They go, yes, 6 weeks, no meetings. We could do that. And then this is what happens. Well, except for the finance committee, of course, they got to meet.
Yeah. Trustees got to meet.
I'm like, you know what? You guys have a lot of summers where nobody does anything for 6 weeks in the middle of summer.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's a discipline to say, okay, somebody might be disappointed. They might not think we're working hard enough, or they might not think, but our mission is what wins.
Yeah.
Our mission requires maybe us, because of what we're going to take on next, we probably need to take a breath, pray, relax, let some things go, right? Yeah.
Well, real quick, I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about here at Chapelwood, but I will say, you know, going back in my notes, so that these four books that you wrote in this series, How Not to Waste a Crisis, The Mission Always Wins, Leading Through Resistance, Invest in Transformation, they're available on Amazon or anywhere.
They will be soon.
They will be soon. Yeah.
So I don't know when this comes out, but they will be starting this summer.
This comes out tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Well, so
you pre-order
week after next will be our pre-order launch.
So in mid-April-ish kind of thing, you can look for these. Yeah. And these are re-examination of four mindsets that result in bad habits for leaders.
Yeah.
And the four that you take on, trying harder at what has been successful in the past, focusing on pleasing historical stakeholders, doing whatever you can to eliminate resistance, and then confusing trust with transformation.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, the one on trust was the one that I snarkingly said, you know, kind of stepped on. You went from preaching to meddling, as they like
to
say.
Exactly.
But it was actually very helpful for me, because what I don't want to do is get, all right, we got this trust, we got this smooth waters, let's just sit and kind of build some more silos. And that's why you're here at Chapelwood now, because we know, and I know, that in order for us to step into the next, if you're just going to try to wait out the next potential thing, like a general conference or a presidential election, then you're never going to do anything, right? I mean, so you're here for us to begin to think intentionally about, okay, now that we've been through all this, now that we've had some shaking out, you know, right, and some settling, we have a clear sense of identity of who we are.
Yeah.
But we have some unique challenges that we face here too, because we have multiple worship communities, we have different campuses. There are ways now we want to start talking about growing and planting communities and engaging in new ways of being the church in certain. So talk a little bit about kind of what you're hoping for as you're here at Chapelwood, and kind of thought that you're bringing, because you worked with us before.
Yeah.
So for folks who listen from Chapelwood, kind of just give us your little synopsis of what we're going to be doing and kind of what your hope for stuff is.
So about 18 months or almost 2 years ago now, we did a pretty deep dive where we looked at, okay, what are the core values that really make Chapelwood Chapelwood? Mm-hmm. And what is the charism? That's the phrase we use. What's the gift that is unique about this church that's offered to the city and the community? And then we started talking about, what do we believe is like God putting on our hearts? I always say, if Jesus was walking through Houston as Chapelwood Church and was hearing, "Son of David, have mercy on me," of all the voices that are calling at him, what would stop? Like when he stopped with a woman who had the issue of blood, what would stop him? What's the thing that you guys hear and go, that pain point? And it's going to be different. It's going to be different in, you know, Spring Branch area. It's good that it'd be here in the villages. It'd be different in some of the places. That's having these campuses actually at gives you the opportunity to go, so if we took our good values and our gifts and we put them in some other places, what uniquely would we offer there? And there's a discernment question, but then there's also a planning question, and then there's a transformation. Like you know, the same way that Jesus' disciples could wander with him, but it took them a while for them to respond the way he did, we want to be able to do the same thing. So I come with basically two questions. One is, what we learned last time, does it still apply? And to what degree have we learned that needs to adapt a little bit? And then second, okay, how do we take that into different places where you guys are beginning to think God is calling you to do some ministry? And what does it look like contextualized to that place as opposed to this neighborhood or that one?
So what about you two? Kind of hope for things as we kind of start this journey? Continue the journey.
I think continuing to look at what are our initiatives, what are the things that we need to be about that God has uniquely gifted us for? How do we live into that boldly? And then, what's next? And what do we have to let go of?
Yeah.
in order to even, back to your point, to remove obstacles? What do we need to let go mm-hmm. of to even be able to wrestle with and think about what the next thing is? One of the things that you said a lot while you were here, and then that I'm doing all this reading for this program on, right, is like that yesterday's successes are today's problems, right? And yeah. so like, what are the things that in our 75-year history at Chapelwood are really amazing things? God has worked in amazing ways, and yet maybe need to change or let go of or whatever in whatever this new thing mm. is that God is stirring. And mm. that's not always easy.
It's not easy at all. Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah. I've always get excited about seeing you and talking mm-hmm. to you about kind of what you're thinking about and just knowing the impact that you've had on this place and mm-hmm. And helping us kind of dream in language that makes sense to us and to our DNA. I'm interested in really discerning what and Sarah and I've been talking this a bit, is what does the shalom in Spring Branch, the shalom of God, look like in Spring Branch? Yeah. And for me, that means it's like hyper-local and hyper-relational. Those two things are coming together for me in a particular way at Chapelwood that I think it's difficult, but it's not hard when we give, like what John was saying, like once you begin to see new things, you want to move towards the Spirit. Mm-hmm. It's not a hard, like I think we all want that, mm-hmm. you know, but so I'm interested and excited about how that begins to emerge in this place and more because it's been emerging.
Me too.
It's a good, yeah, good season. I would say here. From you working with us over the past couple of, how long has it been? Like 2 years?
Two and a half years. Two and a half years.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the marker. My work in Timothy.
There you go. But I would say.
No pants or shoes.
Yeah.
And no pants. Winnie the Pooh in it on Easter Sunday morning. I would say those four things, you know, this understanding of our identity of embodiment. Yeah. of mm-hmm. grace, of embodiment of Jesus, embodied mercy. These four things that we discerned out of that have been things that I would say we've really leaned into.
Yeah.
And I think if the people who come here regularly and listen to what we're about, they get that.
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. it is preached, it is taught, it is modeled.
Mm-hmm. Across the board.
Yeah. This is who we are. We may disagree about a lot of things. We may not see things eye to eye, may not always interpret the Bible, but we're going to embody Jesus to one another, embody grace to one another. Yep. That whole formation piece is kind of tied to that because the embodiment is who we are, but we've been really intentionally about making sure that we're digging deeper. So this this whole place is kind of bathed with some contemplative, the contemplative spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a center for contemplative spirituality, which is always kind of poured into us. But I would say even more so in recent years because coming out of COVID, we needed to engage people to be ready for the next thing that's going to blow up because it will. Mm-hmm. It's coming. It's only a matter of time.
Yep.
The all ages, this, you know, that focusing on all ages. I'll tell you, in the last year, 2 years, I mean, the dynamic kind of focus and growth that we've had on children's and youth ministry, particularly as we kind of thought about the next generation, that was something that the older generation always was like, we've always been a church about children and teenagers and youth. And now I see us intentionally resourcing families, helping parents raise their children, which we've always done, but it just seems to feel like there's a greater level of intentionality about it.
Yeah.
And that moves us to be constantly thinking about how we can do that.
Yeah.
And I think the part of this stage for me is kind of like that alignment, that last part of how we align these systems together with the campuses and everything else. Plus, there's going to be some other things that we're going to need to do and start. Mm-hmm. But then the question of, okay, well, what do we not need to do anymore?
Right. Yeah.
That's always a question because, you know, you always want to do something new, but not everybody wants to turn things off.
Yeah.
Churches are horrible about turning things off.
Oh, dear Lord.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Think of how many churches, if you just tour a church and there's a closet, it's like, how come nobody got rid of the flannel graph? Mm-hmm. Like, how come we have chalkboards? Like, why do we still have chalk?
I don't understand. Hoarders and missed it. You could have done small church closets.
Small church closets.
Right. Oh, because there's stuff. I mean, there's stuff dating back from 50 years ago. A painted backboard. Vacation Bible School, 1952. It's like, but we kept that because we might use it again.
Might use it again.
All right, brother. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we were able to kind of share a little bit about your new books coming up, and I hope everybody will check those out, especially if you're in ministry and you're engaged in leadership. And you know what? Even if you're just a parent and you're leading your family, the stuff applies everywhere.
And there are pictures. There's even pictures.
There's drawings. There's like almost like cartoon drawings in there that kind of give a sense of all of it. So you got to make sure you go and see all that. Make sure you subscribe and like the podcast. Share it with other people. And share this with folks who maybe have read Todd's stuff before and want to learn more about this new resource that they have available to them as well. Because they won't regret. You might get mad at it, but you won't regret it. It'll push you out of your comfort zone. That's good. Well, I'm John Stevens.
I'm Matt Russell.
You're Todd Bolsinger. You're Todd Bolsinger.
I'm Todd Bolsinger.
No, you still are. You were 30 minutes ago.
I still am, but I just didn't know when I was supposed to say that.
Yeah.
And I'm Sarah Barnett.
This is why you should always give people instructions. It's kind of like on Easter Sunday, one of our pastors got up and said, "He is risen," and everybody went,
Yeah.
Where?
I said, you have to tell them how this works.
Yes. So,
he is risen indeed. All right. So we finally figured it out. It was good. Well, I've already said I'm John Stevens, and I still am. And this is Pod Have Mercy.